This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is Episode 57, Samaya Downing, Part 2. 4-year-old Samaya Downing was living with her father and his girlfriend in Adelanto, California, in December of 2012 when police received a report from a witness that something very bad had happened to Samaya. Police interviewed the couple, and within hours, authorities received information that led them to a shallow grave in the California desert, where they discovered Samaya's body with unimaginable injuries. The story that emerged was a horror of daily beatings, confinement, and diabolical torture, including the water deprivation that ultimately led to Samaya's death, and later, the arrest and conviction of 3 people. Last week, I told you the story of Samaya's life, her death, and the nearly 9-year criminal case that ensued. In this episode, you'll hear my interview with the prosecutor in Samaya's case, San Bernardino County Deputy District Attorney Justin Crocker, who spent years pushing toward justice for the sweet, happy 4-year-old girl with the big brown eyes. This is part 2 of the tragic story of Samaya Downing. Today on the podcast, I have a very special guest. I'm speaking with Justin Crocker, who is the San Bernardino County, California Deputy District Attorney and the lead prosecutor on Samaya's case. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for telling Samaya's stories and so many other stories. It's extremely important that people get to know Samaya and also that these stories are told so that hopefully it doesn't happen again to poor children like Samaya.
Right. I think the awareness is so important because then we'll learn what to watch for. I definitely wasn't as aware of what certain symptoms and signs were before I started doing this. So it's been an eye opener, that's for sure.
Absolutely. And as I'm sure you've talked about in COVID times with children not seeing the teachers like they normally would and being out of the house as much as they normally would, it's more important than ever probably to try and catch it. And if you see something, report or say something.
Exactly. Yeah. The lack of mandatory reporter access is kind of scary for a lot of people.
It really is.
So why don't we start by going over your background and, you know, how long you've been deputy district attorney and that sort of thing. You said you're a professor.
Yes. So I've been a deputy district attorney here in San Bernardino County for a little over 7 years now. And I also am an adjunct professor at the law school that I actually attended. Here in our community, and I've been an adjunct for now 5 years, I believe, teaching on topics in the area of criminal law or trial advocacy.
And did you start your career in San Bernardino County?
I did. I grew up in San Bernardino County, then came back home for law school and started interning in the DA's office as a law student. And I never left. They couldn't get rid of me. So I was thankful to get hired right out of law school and have been here ever since.
That's great. And how, but as far as these cases go, I know it's got to be difficult, but did you start prosecuting Samaya's case from the start or did you kind of jump in at some point?
No, I did not start from the beginning of the filing in this case. This case was filed at the very end, really in the last day or two of 2012. At that time, I hadn't even been sworn in yet. About 3 years ago, I took over the position that I'm in now, which is within our major crimes division. And Samaya's case was assigned to our major crimes division. So I was actually the third prosecutor on the case over the 8-year period that it was being litigated because the other prosecutors, one of them promoted and the other became a judge. So I took over Samaya's case about 3 years ago.
That must have been a lot of information to take in and go over.
It is. Yeah, there was, took over several cases, but Samaya stuck out from the very beginning. Her picture was on the inside of the case file, and you open up all the case files and look at the new cases you're inheriting, and Samaya's face from that very moment was ingrained in my mind. And this case, because of that and everything she went through, had a special place, obviously.
Yeah, I'm sure. Sure. Those big brown eyes. I mean, once you take a look at those, you're not going to forget them.
Never.
So have you prosecuted murder cases prior to this one?
I have. So okay. I've prosecuted only homicide cases the last about 3.5 years of my career. So it's these days, it's pretty much only murder cases in this particular division that I'm assigned to.
Wow, that's got to be rough. That's a pretty dark area to be in, but the justice end of it must be just so rewarding, you know, when you do get a conviction.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no shortage of motivation to work hard to get the result we want in each case because of the horrific facts that come out about each case and each victim. Obviously, Samaya's as bad and tragic as you can get.
Yeah, for sure. And as far as the public hearing a lot of details, your office must just hear so many more that you don't even go into.
Absolutely. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's all too common. And so these cases, come in on a somewhat routine basis, unfortunately. Maybe not the same degree that Samaya went through. Hopefully those are more rare, but unfortunately these cases come into our office too often, and we have to review them and do the best we can to get what justice we can.
Well, I appreciate the work you put in on this one. It definitely has been a long haul. And
thank you very much.
When you first took over the case, what were your initial impressions about it?
Well, the first thing is just the horrific nature of the facts. As I said, the first impression is Samaya's beautiful face, because like I said, the picture that the office put out with the press release, her preschool picture, was right on the inside cover. So thankfully the first impression was just a beautiful little girl. And then as you start to go through the file and learn what happened to her, see the evidence, and break it down, then, the details that you're covering become the focus of everything you're thinking about in this case, and how to make sure that her story is told so that we can get the result we want in this case.
When you learned about the three defendants, what did you think of them and their participation in it?
Well, what I'll say is that I was extremely motivated to make sure that convictions were, I did everything I could to make sure again that the story came out so that I could obtain convictions. Rayshon Stanch had already received his plea agreement from a prior prosecutor on the case. And so when I inherited the case, Bianca Stanch and Ronald Greer were left to be prosecuted. And Rayshon Stanch had now agreed to cooperate and testify. So my focus was those two defendants, and I was motivated, I guess is the way I'll put it, to make sure that convictions were obtained.
As you've said, the case kind of dragged on for over 8 years, despite the objections of your office. And I know we talked a little bit about this offline, but was that, do you think, a tactic on the part of the defendants, particularly Ronald, who had so many different attorneys? It was hard to follow that path.
Yeah, I can't speculate on the particular attorneys in this case or Ronald Greer's thoughts. But I will say that delaying the trial from happening and from starting can be a defense tactic. I guess that's all I can say is it can be. The details of how it went, year by year for 8 years before it made it to trial, the prosecution was ready for several of those years and defense was not. So beyond that, I wouldn't speculate, but obviously as a prosecutor, you want to present the evidence as well as you can. And the more time that goes by, memory fades and the evidence certainly doesn't become stronger over time. So you're always doing your best to try and get the case to trial as soon as possible, while also making sure that the defendants have attorneys that are ready so that they can be adequately represented.
Sure. You want to try to avoid at least that part of the appeal process.
Ineffective assistance of counsel is a common grounds for an appeal. And yeah, definitely you don't want, first you want the defendant to make sure that they have their constitutional rights upheld. Obviously the role of the prosecutor is to make sure that occurs as well. But beyond that, you want to protect your convictions on appeal. And yeah, ineffective assistance of counsel is a claim that defendants can and often do make to try and get convictions overturned. So we want to make sure we do everything we can on the front end to avoid that on the back end.
Can you talk about what the defendants told the police to begin with that led them to find Samaya out there in the desert?
Sure. So what happened is that Rayshon Stanch, a couple days after Samaya's murder, moved out. So he was living with Ronald Greer and Bianca Stanch pretty much throughout December of 2012. Samaya was killed, we believe, the night of December 15th, 2012. Definitely around there, but Rayshon seems to remember, and the dates seem to line up with late that night on December 15th. He moved out a couple days after that, and about a week and a half, actually about 10 or 11 days later, on the 26th of December, he finally cracked. He was the first person, it appears, of the three that cracked and told somebody. And he told his sister and her then boyfriend. So the boyfriend, hearing that, the boyfriend of Rayshon's sister, immediately called 911 to report what Rayshon had just told him. So that's when law enforcement became involved. Rayshon's initial statements to the police, and this came out at trial, were somewhat inconsistent at first. And then finally, by the second or third interview, he indicated that Samaya had been murdered and that she'd been buried in the desert. At that time, Ronald Greer was taken into custody, and the next day, Bianca Stanch was taken into custody. Ronald Greer's initial statements were that Samaya was with her grandfather and safe, and with another family member and safe. He also had a version where he indicated that she was with a friend of his that he met on Instagram or social media, and that Samaya was safe. Eventually, after hours and hours of interviews with some phenomenal detectives, he admitted her death. And then Bianca Stanch, her version of events initially was that Samaya was also safe with a grandfather or family member. And then she quickly turned to blaming Rayshon for what occurred, and that the night of Samaya's death, her, Bianca Stanch, and Ronald Greer went to dinner, and that Rayshon must have done something while they were at dinner. So that was kind of their initial statements to law enforcement. And then the detectives put Ronald Greer and Bianca Stanch in the same room, and the story kind of evolved.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So they didn't know at the time that she had died from dehydration ultimately, and that would certainly point to a longer death and time frame.
Correct. Especially if seeing the pictures of Samaya's body after she was exhumed, her body was exhumed. There's so many injuries to her body that anyone would think that the injuries to her body must have been the cause of her death. So it's very likely that the defendants also believed that. You'd have to think they thought it played a part in that. The dehydration is something that had to be shown and seen through expert eyes when the pathologist performed the autopsy to find out that, in fact, it was the dehydration, not those injuries, that ultimately caused Samaya's death.
Did the experts testify at all about how long they had forced her to go without water?
They testified to the best of their ability. And the difficulty is, as they testified, they don't know whether she was just denied completely all water or any liquids for a consistent period of time. And if so, that could have been, you know, as little as 24 to 48 hours, or if she was just given too little an amount for a more extended period of time. So we don't know if it was just purely not a single drop of water for a 24 to 48 hour period, or perhaps a longer period of days where she was just being given, or somehow she was finding her way to little sips. Based on the facts, it honestly could have been both or some combination thereof.
And they had said, it might have been even in the office's press release about the cleaning solution that she ended up drinking. Did that have any part in her death?
No, I don't believe so. The cleaning solution So she drank bleach out of from under the sink, and that occurred that we know of one time, because the defendants admitted to a family friend or to a friend of theirs that that had occurred, and that was months before Samaya's death. So that occurred earlier in 2012. So that's all we know about the drinking of the bleach. As far as timing, the only incident we know of occurred well before Samaya's murder. So as far as that playing a role in her death, it doesn't appear so. There was nothing from the autopsy that indicated that. But obviously it shows her treatment and how she was being treated.
Sure. It sounds like she was not only malnourished and dehydrated, but abused and tortured. And the part about the boiling water really, that sticks with you. It's just terrible. I can't imagine how any person can do that, let alone someone who's supposed to protect her.
Yeah, that's the fact that sticks out. I think it stuck out very early. And that's the one that, you know, it becomes difficult to even when you boil a pot of water at home for whatever reason, when you're cooking or making something, when you're going through a case like this, it's hard to look at that the same after that, because it's just unfathomable that someone would do that. But it's also one of those facts that almost just speaks for itself. You know, as a trial attorney, just sometimes you got to play it up with words, and then there's some conduct that you just have to say what happened and let jurors just think about it. And that's what happened in this case.
How long had Samaya actually been with Ronald and Bianca? Because before that, she was living with her mother's family.
Correct. It seems, and again, this is one of those facts that over 8 years became a little bit more difficult to nail down. But there was testimony at trial related to when she fully went into Ronald Greer's custody and never came back. And it was early in 2012, in the early months of 2012. She went to Ronald Greer and ended up never going back to any of her other family members.
And was that because he was keeping her from her mom?
No, the evidence at trial seems to suggest that he wasn't necessarily hiding her at the beginning, that it just seemed like he was in a better position perhaps at that time to keep her. And the family had no reason to believe that she was unsafe. There was nothing that, you know, Mr. Greer had indicated to them that he had never indicated he didn't want her there. He never indicated anything to the family, according to their testimony, that he was having any difficulties. So it just seems that seemed to work out. She was still somewhat local here in the Southern California area, and just nobody could even fathom what was happening to her. And so it really wasn't questioned. And Samaya seemed to be doing okay. But obviously, as 2012 went by, that changed.
So at some point, they did start keeping her from the rest of the family. And then they moved a couple of times, I believe one of the family members said.
Correct. Yeah. There was some testimony at trial from the family that they had moved about, I think, twice up here in this area of Southern California. It's the high desert area. And that they hadn't shared their new address. At least that was the testimony at trial. And so it was difficult for family members to locate her.
I've seen that a lot of times. It's pretty common with child abusers that they will just move and not tell anyone where they're going. And some people can't fathom that, you know, well, Facebook's a thing, you can find them, but it's not easy to track someone down necessarily.
Absolutely. And Mr. Greer, Ronald Greer, was even towards the end, the evidence showed that he was hiding from his own mother. So it wasn't just from the mother's side of the family, of Samaya's mother, it was also from his own mother. So, you know, your own mom can't find you. That just shows you how difficult it can be for family members to locate you if you don't want to be found.
Right, sure. Now, who was, I know there was a CPS case open for Samaya in December. Who was that against? Was it that on Ronald?
So what happened was Samaya went to school. She was enrolled in preschool in 2012. She started in late September of 2012. And then she showed up to school, I believe it was October 2nd, if I recall correctly, but one of the first days of October, with a black eye, an injury to right below her eye, and also some swelling in the eye socket area. And so the teachers noticed that, asked her about it. And Samaya indicated that Bianca Stanch had hit her with a belt, and that's what caused the injury to the eye. The teachers asked Ronald Greer about it that day when Samaya was dropped off. And Ronald Greer said that Samaya had been hit by her little brother. And her little brother was not even living. Her little brother was living with Samaya's mother, not even in the house. So that's completely false and fabricated. And he admitted so later. So the teachers not only became suspicious, but had confirmed evidence of something, you know, at least that Bianca Stanch had likely caused this injury. So the preschool teacher reported that to what we call now CFS, Child and Family Services, but same thing as CPS, basically. And so that opened the investigation into Ronald Greer and Bianca Stanch in early October 2012.
There hasn't been that much news coverage on the case, just a few local pieces throughout the years. But then, of course, when the sentencing happened, it started getting a lot more attention. That's when I learned about it, and it just caught my attention right away. It was, of course, so egregious. And, you know, just like you said, her picture just will catch your eye and grab your heart. She's just so adorable.
Yeah, it absolutely will. You know, we're in a unique area in Southern California where we are neighbored by two large counties, Los Angeles County and Orange County. And so the news, sometimes it's difficult because it's such a highly populated area out here. And then, you know, Samaya's murder happened very close in time and is somewhat similar to the murder of Gabriel Fernandez. So we sometimes have stories like Samaya's that get some attention and then kind of fade out because there's just it's such a highly populated area. But now that the sentencing came out, I'm glad to see Samaya's face at least shown a little bit more so that people get to see that beautiful face and hear her story. And hopefully we don't have another victim out there that has to go through what she went through.
Exactly. I know Gabriel's case has gotten a lot more attention since the Netflix documentary, of course. And I've gotten a lot of requests to cover it, but at this point it's been covered so thoroughly by the documentary. And there are so many other cases where these kids did not get the attention. But I do remember Gabriel's case happening at the time and hearing about it was just awful. And I noticed on Twitter that you and the prosecutor in that case are connected as well.
Yeah, I reached out to John Hitami after I watched the documentary, actually, just because I thought he did a great job really representing what a prosecutor should be in a case like this. And obviously was successful in his prosecution. And he emailed me back and we exchanged just a couple emails. But it's, I watched the documentary as well. And you can't help but think of Samaya, of course, because it's just the horrific treatment. Some of it was identical and some of it was quite similar. Like being locked up. Samaya went through something similar, being locked in rooms for long periods of time. And it's you can't help once you have victims, like we've talked about already, their face is in your mind. When you hear anything similar, you can't help but think of them and what they went through.
Exactly. I know I've covered close to 100 cases between the podcast and the blog. And if I had to follow the parallels among all of them, I'd have one of those boards like you see on Criminal Minds with the lines running from here to there and everywhere. It's crazy how these people think alike. These abusers tend to use a lot of the same tactics. It's very disturbing.
Yep. And that's what's so important about the work you're doing is highlighting the similarities, because obviously that would be the easiest way to find and notice these patterns of abuse, is seeing the most common patterns amongst the worst tragedies, I guess. Again, I thank you for doing that work.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't think necessarily to look for a lock on the outside of the bedroom door, something like that. You know, that's just the kind of thing that maybe wouldn't catch somebody's eye necessarily, unless they know about some of these stories. But that's definitely, that one stood out here. And I've heard that, unfortunately, in other cases too, but it sounds like I'm not sure why they would have wanted to keep Samaya when clearly Bianca had issues with her. It sounded like she had a very strong dislike for this poor little girl.
Yeah, I don't, a lot of things came out at the trial. It was a somewhat lengthy trial. A lot of testimony was given, but as to why they didn't just call one of the other family members who would have been happy to take her, I don't know if we'll ever have an answer to that question. Certainly didn't come out at trial.
Yeah, sometimes it seems like they're just happy
having someone to take out their anger on. And it's just awful to think that, you know, she had a little sister in the house who was,
Under 2 years old.
Yeah. So to think that that little girl was in the house and being treated perfectly well. And so Maya had to think, what am I doing wrong?
Absolutely. It's, as you get deeper, the injuries, the physical injuries jump out at you when you review this case, like so many others, but sitting down and thinking about the emotional injuries and the emotional pain really sometimes is worse than even these horrific physical injuries as you really think about it and what she was going through. And Samaya's, you make a good point because she sat there and watched, and there was evidence at trial that on occasions she'd go to friends' houses, the kids would be taken over and Samaya would be told she couldn't have, for instance, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but that her little sister could have one and the other kids, there were multiple kids in the house. And Samaya would have to sit there and not eat while other kids got food. So you can just imagine what, as a child, you would be going through your head and trying to figure out this unexplainable conduct. Right. It's bad.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing also that people would not really necessarily think to look out for. But that's another one that there was a child recently. I can't remember where it was, but he was in a restaurant with his parents and they weren't allowing him to eat. And a waitress noticed this and asked him if he needed help by holding up a sign and ended up saving him. His parents were arrested. So people being vigilant like that is just unbelievably helpful and incredibly important.
Absolutely. That's amazing. And you never know what you're preventing. Whether it's, any level of abuse, when you're preventing it, you're really doing so much and saving so much for that child.
Hopefully, that's the idea here, is learning more about it, on a personal level, but also being able to have the platform to spread that knowledge. I feel fortunate to be able to do that for these kids and keep their names out there so they don't get forgotten.
Absolutely. And again, I'll say it the whole time. I appreciate it. And it's so meaningful. Those of us that get it understand how important that is.
Thank you. And it's another thing is there's a million true crime podcasts out there, but no one wants to touch the kids' cases. They're hard. They're very hard to do. So I understand that completely because I have immersed myself in it. It's very tough on a person, especially someone with a lot of empathy, but it's so important. Like I said, they were innocent. They had nothing to do with what happened to them. And these people just took advantage of them in every possible way. And it's a shame all around.
Yeah, it really is. And it does. It carries an extra toll. And, on my side, I don't deal exclusively with child cases. In fact, it's rare amongst my whole caseload to have it, but there are detectives, law enforcement officers, and prosecutors who exclusively work on these cases, and they are the absolute best of the best. And the emotional toll that takes on them, I think they understand, but they know the work is worth it and it needs to be done. So my hat is always off to them because it's different when you try these cases or work with these cases or look into these cases and have to then just go out into the world and see a child or see what should be a normal situation, but you are vigilant or you're thinking of, what you have reviewed or what you're working on. And it definitely changes your outlook on life. So again, my hat's off to the law enforcement officers and prosecutors that work with these every day, because it's not easy. And I know that.
Oh, definitely. They're the heroes. That's for sure. I mean, it can't be easy for them, but there's been a lot of cases that I've talked about where there were law enforcement or prosecutors that I've started little fan clubs in my mind for. They're just so incredible. They just go through every detail and make sure that every I is dotted, every T is crossed, and they don't want any room for error. These people can't just walk free. It happens too often already. So yeah, that's a tough job, but thank goodness they're doing it. Now, can you talk at all about what Samaya's injuries included as far as what was visible or what they might have been trying to hide?
Yeah. So her body and I think you're covering this or you've covered this, but she eventually is buried in the desert near a city called Barstow, California. And thankfully, because it's December, It was pretty cold out in the desert at that time. So it preserved her body very well, even though she was left out there for a period of at least 11 days, more likely about 12 days. And so the thankful part of that for us trying to prosecute these crimes and figure out what happened is that it preserved her body. And once her body was exhumed and the autopsy was performed, what you see and found were injuries literally from her ankles all the way to the top of her head. And the injuries included signs of beating marks, the U-shape that I'm sure you've encountered in child abuse cases as you've reviewed them, these U-shaped marks, which are consistent with using some sort of cord and kind of putting, you know, two pieces of it and hitting it. It creates that U-shape. So Samaya had several of those throughout her body, again, from her ankles really all the way up to the top of her head. The U-shape injuries were, there was at least 10 of them, up to 20, depending on if you kind of zoom in and think, oh, maybe that's a partial U or not. Then, and most of those U-shaped injuries were testified to by the experts that those occurred within hours of her death, most likely somewhere in the window of a couple hours to at most 24 hours. Then there were several other just straight injuries that could have been caused and likely were in this case by a belt or something other, some other similar object. And most of those again were fresh. So within 24 hours of her death, those were front and back, both on her chest, her legs, her thighs had several of those injuries. And again, all the way up to her face had U-shaped marks and also injuries that look like they could have come from something like a belt. Then her forehead had a pretty severe injury to it, blunt force injury to it, split the skin. It didn't fracture her skull, but it was significant. And that was very apparent when you first saw her body. Then the largest, just in size, injury that was on her body was the injury from the boiling water. So her back, unfortunately, the top of her shoulders, had very clear and obvious signs of having a boiling liquid, or at least hot enough to rip the flesh, unfortunately, poured on her in what were referred to as slippage of the skin. And that was all over the top of her back and on her shoulders, and then some what would probably be splash marks onto her chest. So that was kind of a summary of several injuries up and down her body that were found at autopsy.
Wow, that's awful. Just the thought of where that rage could come from in a 19-year-old woman, or, you know, even a 21-year-old man, just the thought of them taking it out on her like that is beyond comprehension for most people, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And to inflict an injury like that and then no medical attention sought. I agree with your assessment of doing that just in the first place, but then obviously she was not, well, it shouldn't be obvious, but the facts indicate and show that clearly they did not seek any medical attention. She was not taken to a doctor or hospital, urgent care, anything like that. So she just had to sit and suffer as her body tried to work through that injury and all the injuries. And the thing is that perhaps sticks with me maybe the most when I really think about the case is how strong Samaya was, because despite these horrific injuries, top to bottom on her body, she would have survived all of it. She was tough enough that the both our pathologist, meaning the pathologist that we called who worked for the coroner's office, and the defense themselves hired an expert and called an expert pathologist, both agreed that she would have survived the injuries to her body. It was the dehydration ultimately that was the cause of death. So to think just how tough she was, that she's enduring this over and over, and it's not, had she just been given some water, she would have likely survived it. It's tough to think about, but just, you can get an idea of just how strong Samaya was.
Right. Yeah. That definitely makes it very hard to think about. And I just feel so much for her mother and the rest of the family. It's got to be on their mind 24 hours a day. Have you spoken to them since the sentencing at all?
Not since the sentencing. No, the, as we are recording this, the sentencing occurred, a few weeks ago now, and or a couple weeks ago. They were the present, of course, and we spoke at the end of that. And that's the last time that I've talked to them as of now.
And I'm sure they were very relieved, at least that part of it is over.
Yeah, they were. Relief is probably the best word, from just my, observing them and knowing them for the 3 years that I've been on the case. And, you know, it's a long process. You and I, we talked a little bit before we started recording about just sitting and waiting and how difficult that can be on the victim's family and everybody involved. And certainly this 8-year process has been excruciating for them.
Yeah.
So definitely. I know they were relieved.
Yeah. It is definitely one of the longer ones that I've heard of. It's a,
yeah.
That's why I wondered about the, you know, musical attorneys game that they might've been playing. It did seem like that was somewhat, at the very least, somewhat intentional, but at least it is, like you said, it's over at this point for them. Now all they have to go through is Rayshon sentencing on April 23rd, I think it is.
Yes, I believe that's correct. Yeah. And that's what, when COVID hit, the concern was, obviously jury trials ceased just like basically everything else. But our concern was this another reason for delay. But thankfully we were able to push strongly, to argue that this was, the case, if any case should get priority to get out once jury trials resumed, with social distancing and masks and different things, that this should be on the top of the pile because of the seriousness of the case and the age of the case. And, thankfully the office I work for pushed hard for that. And the judges pushed us to the top of the pile, and we were able to get the trial out in 2020 so that we didn't get to year 9 and make it even worse.
Right. That is great. Yeah. The trial went from, what was it, July of 2020 through October?
Yes. The last couple of days of July, we got assigned a courtroom and kind of got the ball rolling. And then the verdict came at the beginning of October.
It was, I think I counted 30 full days of testimony and evidence, and that's a lot of work.
It was. We were actually, I think, somewhat fortunate as far as COVID quarantining. We only had a 2-week break in there while one of the defendants was quarantined. So it was a lot, but it could have been worse. And we were obviously concerned that some sort of COVID outbreak, and obviously we wanted everyone to be safe, could really derail it, you know, even on day 29. The later we got, the harder it was to imagine if we got halted, but we got through it and thankfully got to a verdict.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, can you talk at all about what Ronald testified to at trial and how much he claimed to know or didn't?
Sure. Ronald Greer chose to take the stand. He testified essentially that he had developed a drug habit, a severe drug habit in that late portion of 2012, and that he was regularly using cocaine, marijuana, and I believe he testified also he was drinking alcohol daily, and that he wasn't present, that he was not aware of any abuse, and that essentially he knew nothing about her condition. As far as the deprivation of water, his testimony was only that at a certain time each day, he would stop her from, her being Samaya, from drinking water in an effort to stop her from wetting the bed at night. So that was his testimony about his knowledge of what was occurring, and that he testified essentially that her death was completely out of the blue, that when he returned from dinner that night and found her dead, he was completely caught off guard and knew nothing about the injuries. And that, in fact, he said, he testified that he never saw the injuries, even when he placed her in her sleeping bag and then buried her in the desert, that even it wasn't until he got to court after he'd been charged with these crimes and some of the pictures were shown at different hearings that he knew about any of the injuries to her body. So yeah, obviously he had the opportunity to testify and I had the opportunity to cross-examine him, and the jury most importantly had the opportunity to determine if they felt that he was being truthful. And that was all, I'm sure, a part of their verdict is assessing his testimony with all the other evidence.
Sure. Yeah. Just based on his Facebook feed alone, I mean, the fact that he could say he was suddenly addicted to alcohol and marijuana. That's all his Facebook feed talked about. So I can't imagine it would have taken over his life any more than it already had.
One of the interesting things that came out is the day that he was arrested, I believe that was late in the night on December 26th. It might've been into the 27th. They actually, law enforcement had the foresight to obtain a warrant and get a blood draw done. So we had his blood, law enforcement did back in 2012, had his blood tested for all sorts of substances, including cocaine. And the active ingredient that one would expect to find for such, for the type of use that Ronald Greer testified to at trial, how much cocaine he said he was using and how often, you would, an expert testified in our rebuttal case that you'd expect to find the active ingredient in testing his blood, and it came back negative for that. So again, the jury got to see that and hear all of that evidence in determining whether they believed his testimony.
I love when science saves the day like that. Did Ronald and Bianca ever request severance of their trials, or was it just severance of Rayshon's that they looked for?
The only motion that was filed was a severance of Rayshon's trial from the other two defendants. And that became a non-issue when Rayshon accepted a plea bargain, because obviously that took him out of the trial process. But as far as severance from each other, that motion was never filed.
That's interesting. Okay. So they didn't try to pin it on each other necessarily.
Yeah. At trial, they didn't. Ronald's testimony was nothing about, you know, the boiling injuries and all the types of injuries that Rayshon testified to observing Bianca inflict on Samaya. Ronald did not confirm any of those injuries, outside of, he did testify that there were a couple spankings or whoopings, I think he referred to them as, that he observed, but nothing explaining the injuries that we outlined here today. So they did not, I wouldn't say that they pinned it on each other. The arguments seem to be more that perhaps Rayshon inflicted these injuries because he was babysitting Samaya the night she died.
Wow. What did he have to say on the stand other than just confirming that he saw Bianca inflict a lot of those injuries?
Rayshon, he tested, he laid out what he observed in the weeks that he was living there. And so that included what he described as daily abuse by Bianca on Samaya, that Ronald Greer was certainly present for many of the acts, including the boiling water incident, that it was routine during the time he lived there to see Greer and Bianca Stanch deny Samaya food or water for long periods of time. And he testified that during the last day or two, he couldn't recall if it was the dinner the night before, which would have been December 14th, or if it was December 13th, but that there was an incident one of those nights where Bianca Stanch made dinner for the family, and that Samaya didn't like shrimp, and so she did not want to eat it. And she was told by Bianca, then you'll go hungry, sent to bed, and that from that point going forward, Rayshon said that Samaya was never given any food or water, at least while he was home. And he was home for much of the time until she died on the night of the 15th.
Wow. Were any of the three employed at the time?
Ronald Greer definitely was. He had a job, and I don't know if it was testified to or not, but I believe he was working, or it came out at trial that he was working. And Rayshon Stanch did not, and Bianca Stanch, as far as anything that came out of trial, was also not working.
Okay.
Rayshon Stanch has a pretty severe, some disabilities that he, lives with. And one is he's legally blind. And it also, it came out at trial that he's has developmental disabilities. Mm-hmm. So he certainly wasn't working. His sister testified that he's had these disabilities since he was a young child. And so he certainly didn't have a job or was not working at that time.
And just to clarify for anyone who doesn't understand, legally blind doesn't mean you can't see at all.
Correct. Yeah, no, he could see, but just very short windows in front of him. Ronald Greer actually told detectives that Rayshon Stanch, for instance, if there were no lights on in a room, even if it was dimly lit, where, you know, you and I would normally be able to see that Rayshon Stanch was completely blind unless there were lights on, which was another interesting thing that he told detectives, because at trial, he testified that he, when Tamaya's body was placed in her princess sleeping bag, that Ronald Greer said him and Rayshon put her body in the sleeping bag inside of the dark bedroom where she died. So that was never really, I asked him about it. The jury got to determine their own conclusions based on his answers of how someone who can't see at all in that kind of environment, like Rayshon Stanch, could help move a child's body into a sleeping bag and zip it up so that they could take her to the desert.
Not the kind of thing you do by feel, that's for sure.
Exactly. But I suppose if it's dark, then maybe it'd be easier to believe he didn't see the injuries.
With all the video conferencing and virtual meetings going on these days, we all want to look our best. If you're like me, you're probably confused by all the different methods of teeth whitening on the market. Now that I'm partnering with Smile Brilliant, I've learned a few things that you might find helpful about home teeth whitening methods. For example, LED lights are a novelty item. Whitening strips neglect the gum lines, crevices, and molars. Charcoal is abrasive and wears down your enamel. And whitening toothpaste only works on surface stains. So if none of these miracle products really works, what does? The number one product recommended by dentists is the custom-fitted tray, which usually costs an arm and a leg because they require a dentist to make them by hand using a model of your teeth. With Smile Brilliant's Lab Direct process, you can get custom-fitted teeth whitening trays at a fraction of the price without a single visit to the dentist. Using an exact model of your teeth, Smile Brilliant's lab technicians will handcraft your trays to give you the best possible whitening results. All you have to do is visit smilebrilliant.com, and when you order their system, make sure you use the coupon code CHILDREN at checkout for 30% off. When you receive the package from Smile Brilliant, it's really simple. You just make your dental impressions at home and return them using the prepaid envelope they provide you. In a matter of 1 week, Smile Brilliant will have your trays back in the mail. Using my coupon code, CHILDREN, means you're supporting me while saving a huge amount of money. So check out smilebrilliant.com today.
I'm just wondering if you can speak at all to what you learned about Tamaya herself after her family testified and knowing them for the last few years.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what you learn is that it was a happy and healthy little girl. She was referred to by family as a little peanut, and she was just a sweetheart. At sentencing, we had the opportunity to show some photographs and videos that weren't relevant and we weren't able to show to the jury. And that included some home videos from Chuck E. Cheese, some birthday parties, and some holidays. And what you see there is just a completely happy and normal little girl. And as I talked about before, you know, this is the strength that she had to go through what she went through is incredible. To go through everything that she had every day, and for her body again, to take all these injuries and was still recovering and moving forward, it was just, she needed some water. It's all she needed from her dad and her, you know, dad's girlfriend. It's just horrific to think about, but it was just an amazing little girl who went through as horrible a time as I can ever imagine. And I'm just so happy that at a minimum we held, you know, her dad and his girlfriend accountable as much as we can under the laws in California, and she won't be forgotten because of, you know, the work that we were able to do in the courtroom, and now the work that people like you are doing to keep her story going, because she's worth remembering. That much I can say with as certain as I can say anything else in life, is that Tamaya is worth remembering.
Absolutely. Yeah. She didn't get much of a chance to tell her own story, so now we'll tell it for her.
Absolutely.
What do you think the likelihood is that Bianca or Ronald will ever get parole?
That is just too unknown for me to even comment on. It's there's so many other factors in play with changes in the law. And so that's really difficult to know, because of there's been a lot of changes just in the last several years in California in when certain defendants are eligible for parole hearings. And so Those can remain in place. Those can change. It's really unknown. And unfortunately, that's the conversation we have to have with victims' families in these situations is we don't know. We know what we can do here on the front end or try to accomplish. Beyond that, it's just really unknown.
Right.
We know they're supposed to serve 32 years before they get a parole hearing. At least that's the sentence that they received, 32 to life. But when they will get that first opportunity at parole, it's just, we don't know.
Do they have to serve 100% of their sentence?
That's another unknown. So they, under the way the law was written or has been written, yes. But there have been changes in the law that allow for changing the sentencing credits that are received at the prison. And so that can apply to them, and it might. And then there's other changes in the law that also kind of come in to play that could allow for them to, at least try to get a parole hearing before that time. So it's all just unknown. It really is to me and to all of us working on this side of things is we don't know what's the law going to be next year. What's going to be the year after? And we just kind of sit back, watch and do what we can here on the front end.
Yeah. It's so hard not to know, but hopefully the family will be able to find some peace at the very least that they're behind bars for now.
Yeah, I sure hope so.
They definitely deserve to be able to move on and keep Samaya's memory alive without having to think about those awful people while they think about her.
Yeah. That's all I guess that they can have at this point. But while they focus on just what an amazing little girl she was, she really was.
Yeah, she really sounded like a sweetheart. Thank you so much for all your hard work in getting those convictions. That's so important. And I'm sure the family is extremely grateful.
Oh, absolutely. As I tell families, it's an honor. Someone has to do this work and someone needs, it's important work. And it's an honor that I had the opportunity to tell Samaya's story. And that's the way I look at it. And I'm just happy that we got the result that we wanted. So thank you for saying that.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you again. And I really appreciate you coming on and talking about Samaya and telling us, not only what she went through, but what kind of a person she was, because they're little, but they're still people and they need to be remembered for that.
Absolutely. And you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
I can't thank Mr. Crocker enough for participating in that interview and for being incredibly gracious for a real-life superhero. It was an honor to speak with him for this episode. That's it for this week. There won't be an episode next week, but I'll be back the following Wednesday, April 21st. Join me then for another case. If you like the show, please follow or subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app, and please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. You can also subscribe on YouTube by searching Suffer the Little Children Podcast. Visit the website at sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes or become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter and TikTok at STLCPod. View photos related to today's episode on Facebook and Instagram. For more stories like the one you heard today, visit sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. This podcast is researched, written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. Intro theme music is by Dream Note Music, and all music for the show is licensed from audiojungle.net. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildrenpod@gmail.com. For more information about preventing or reporting child abuse, visit childhelp.org or call your area's child abuse hotline. If you see something, say something. Until next week, bye everyone.